Before we begin, we have, as you can see, two of our colleagues are absent this morning. It's unavoidable. They will both listen to the tapes of argument. I believe Justice Seda is actually listening to them live, and they will participate in the deliberations. They simply could not be here due to outside circumstances. The first case on calendar this morning is Laborers International Union versus Regional Transit Commission, case number 59345. Counsel for the appellant is Michael Langton. For the respondent, Robert DeLong. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you wish to reserve time?
Yes, I do. 3 minutes, please. Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, honored counsel, my name is Mike Langton. Attorney, I represent Laborers Local 169 and John Russell. In 2001, the Nevada legislature amended NRS 338.141, the statute this court has acknowledged to be the anti-shopping protective statute concerning public works projects in the state of Nevada. The relevant portions of the statute in this appeal are sections 2 and 3. The legislature specifically added the words, quote, the prime contractor, end quote, to subsection 3, such that, effective July 1, 2011, the prime contractor would be required to list itself as a contractor or subcontractor which will perform work on the project. Subsection 2, we believe, requires it to not only list itself, but to identify the work that it will perform. One of the first public works projects bid and awarded after July 1, 2011 was the Reno Consolidated 11-02 Phase 2 Reconstruction Project. That's the project that's at issue in this case. Five prime contractors bid on the project. Appellants believe that none of the bids submitted complied with the new requirements of NRS 338.141. Skip Daly, the business manager of Local 169, immediately contacted RTC and demanded that it deem the bids of the prime contractors not responsive. RTC refused to do so and instead awarded the contract to Spanish Springs Construction. None of the other bidders protested the bid. Appellants then, on August 29, 2011, filed a petition for writ of mandamus, or in the alternative, writ of prohibition, in order to have RTC comply with the requirements of this statute. After a hearing, the district court determined appellants lacked standing, and this appeal is followed. Because the project has been completed, one of the issues in this case is whether the appeal is moot. We submit it is not, but is an exception to the mootness doctrine. In the case of Personhood, Nevada versus Bristol, this court stated, even when an appeal is moot, we may consider it if it involves a matter of widespread importance that is capable of repetition yet evading review, citing Traffic Control Services versus United Rentals. In that case, the court recognized the, quote, capable of repetition yet evading review, end quote, exception to the mootness doctrine when the duration of the challenged action is relatively short and there is a likelihood that a similar issue will arise in the future. Appellants submit the issue will indeed arise in the future again, and the subsequent case is evidence of that because the issues are almost identical. And if this court dismisses the case without addressing the merits of our interpretation of 338.141, we believe that an injustice to the public will be done.
What precisely is the question that you believe is capable of repetition yet evading review that qualifies this under the mootness exception you allude to?
Thank you. We believe that NRS 338.141 subs 3, 2, and 1, and I notice I've said them backwards, are very, very clear. Matter of fact, we argue that they're clear and unambiguous. And so when a public works or a public entity awards a public work project, it must comply with the requirements of that. The question then becomes, can, as in this case, a contractor simply say, I'm going to do 51% of the work? No. Subsection 2 Well, let me back up. Subsection.
So the question as to whether they have to describe the work they're going to perform, that's the question you think?
That's absolutely the question. And in this case, they did not. They just simply signed a document which Judge Adams found to comply with the statute, which we respectfully disagree with, because subsection 1 sets forth who and what is to be done. Subsection 3, which was amended to add specifically the three words, the prime contractor must list itself as a subcontractor if it's going to do any of the work. Subsection 2 says you don't just simply list yourself, you have to describe the work. And in their reply brief, or answering brief, I'm sorry, they admitted that they did not describe the work, they being RTC.
Right. This is a better test case for you than the next one because it's 51% and the other ones are 25%, so we're left to guess what's the 51% that this prime contractor is going to perform.
Right.
The problem I have on the mootness doctrine is you have a statutory procedure for a disappointed competing bidder that allows, it's the statute that follows the one you're putting before us, that says if I put in a bid and I lose and I want to say the bid that was awarded was non-responsive, say because of this statutory defect that you've identified, that there's a whole procedure in the statute for a competing contractor to follow that out. So that entity has a remedy. So why would we say this is capable of repetition yet evading review when there's an express statutory procedure for, admittedly not your clients, but a competing bidder to pursue judicial review of this statute and the infirmity you say existed in this bid?
I believe there's multiple answers to that question.
Long question, I'm sorry.
That's okay. One of which I believe is that RTC has taken the position, number one, that it doesn't have to, a prime contractor doesn't have to. So if RTC itself is going to list a or award another bid, we will now have a precedent here that says, hey, all you have to do is say I'm going to do some of the work or 51% of the work. And the other part is that the legislature, I hate to be repetitive, but I think it's important, specifically wanted prime contractors to start identifying the work so that they couldn't go out after they got the bid and shop. Now, as to whether this is a better case than the second one, I think they each have good merit to them on this, on not only the standing issue but the mootness issue, because in this particular case and also in the next case, the writ of mandamus is supposed to get quick review. We got relatively quick review in this particular one, but by the time the oral argument was had, the briefing for the motion to dismiss was made and everything else, the project had already begun. Now, my client, as a taxpayer and an interested party that represents members, and in this particular case, we believe that it's without a doubt that had they rebid the contract, our people would have gotten jobs. In fact, they may have gotten some anyway because of the listed subcontractors. But the standing, the mootness becomes important because these projects are awarded on one particular day. I think in this particular day is August 18th. And so once the job is awarded, the contractor can start. Once it starts, now they're arguing, oh, you can't do it. It's moot, it's moot, it's moot. And with all due respect to everybody in the room here, if we don't get a decision on this case that says that the statute has to be strictly complied with, I believe that there'll never be a compliance issue. And who, if the subcontractors or the bidding contractors, like you said, if they refuse to, and we don't know the reason why, there could be multiple reasons.
Well, they have to come up with a bond or $250,000.
Exactly. The big, giant bond. They don't want to tick off the awarding body for the future. A number of reasons. We don't know. They're not here. There's nothing in the record as to why. But if the statute is out there, and it's a remedial protective statute, and one of those bidders do not choose to challenge it, that's going to allow all kinds of things in the future where there could be, I'm not saying each and every one of them do, because I truly believe in this case and in the next case, good faith was there. But that doesn't mean that the statute wasn't complied with. But the fact is that somebody has to, in our opinion, have standing to step forward. And I've cited a number of cases that I believe are important to the case, and one of them in this particular case I did not cite, but I would like to cite because I did cite it in the other case, and that's the Rainey versus Borough of Derry, D-E-R-R-Y, the Pennsylvania case, where they set forth a five-part criteria for giving a taxpayer standing whenever somebody else won't step forward. And I would, with all due respect, request that the court look at that one and in both of these cases, because I do think
it would be appropriate to just do a notice of supplemental authorities and give the citation to the clerk and your opposing colleague so they can comment in this case, since they're not, they didn't get the reply brief in the other case.
Okay.
They may have, I don't know.
And why I missed it in this particular case, it's a 1994 case, I can't give an explanation for it. But
you do concede, though, that this project is over and done with, everybody's been paid. It is classically moot unless an exception applies.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There, and that's one of the problems here, is, as I started to say, is because this is a relatively short time frame. And my clients in no way have the ability to post a bond of $250,000 or more to prevent it, because that was one of the arguments that I believe was made as well. If you want an injunction, post a bond. And taxpayers, workers, unions just aren't in that kind of position to do. So we encourage the court, and we hope that the court does find an exception to the mootness doctrine. In this particular case, on the standing issue, Judge Adams
did. Let me pause you there, though. Okay. Would a declaratory judgment action be available to your client?
I don't believe it would be in this particular case, Your Honor.
Okay. Why not?
Because we would have to have an interpretation of the statute, which we're actually asking for here. I mean,
your position is the RTC says they don't need to describe the work.
Pardon me?
You said earlier, unless I misheard you, that the RTC has taken a firm position that the prime contractor need only list the prime contractor's name and not describe the work. If that's their position, why would you not be able to pursue deck relief?
They haven't said that in words. They've said it by implication.
Okay,
by saying that they did comply. So I don't want to put words in their mouth.
Okay, I misunderstood you.
Well, no, I wasn't real clear. I apologize. I should have been. But
by not putting words in their mouth, though, wouldn't you be able to pursue the deck relief once the bids are placed where they don't list what they're going to do?
You know, Your Honor, I apologize. I didn't hear the words.
What I was saying is that, following up on that, once bids are received and the parties don't list what they're going to do, wouldn't you be in a position to go after deck relief at that point, based upon the facts as established?
Possibly, but that's a longer process than the writ process, and by then the mootness argument would be made there. I've got one case out in Fallon, actually, on a petition for declaratory relief. It's been pending for over a year and a half. And so I understand your question. I just don't think that it's appropriate in a time frame that we have to operate on, where the work has to begin or is allowed to begin in an exceptionally short period of time.
And you'd still have the standing problem?
Yes.
I mean, you'd have to clear that hurdle.
Yes.
The difficulty that you're putting forth, though, is that by the time it gets to us, it's complete.
Absolutely. I can't even imagine. Even the Boston Harbor project was like a 14-year project. Once it started, what's going to be the remedy that the court can enter into? I don't believe the court could, at that point, order rebidding of the project. And that's the biggest problem here, is that had the court found we had standing, the court could have ordered that before the project begun. But by the nature of the judicial process and due process, it's just an almost impossible situation to do. In declaratory order, I found don't get the preference that Rich are intended to get. I only have 1 minute to go. I'd like to reserve, if I may.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, honorable members of the court, counsel. My name is Robert DeLong, and I'm representing the Regional Transportation Commission of Washoe County. The key to this case, and I think it's telling that it was never mentioned in argument just now or in the briefs, is that by the union, is the purpose of the statute and whether or not it's being accomplished by the duty sought by the union. That duty has been pointed out is whether or not the prime contractor has to list the work he's going to perform.
So do you agree that we should reach the merits and ignore mootness and standing?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I just think that that's an issue that we should focus in on in this limited time we have, but I'm happy to...
If we focus in on it, why is the statute not clear that they're obligated to list the work to be performed? Because what is missing in the statute that they are not compelled to do that?
A specific directive is what's missing in the statute. Subsection 2 says, the list required by subsection 1 must include a description of the labor or the portion of work which each first-tier subcontractor will perform. There's no express requirement for a prime contractor to list anything within the statute. Similarly, subsection 3 simply says, a prime contractor shall include his or her name. That's the only directive on the prime contractor, is to put his name down on the list, his or her name down on the list.
So you, in effect, would give the statute no meaning based upon what you're giving us now?
Absolutely.
No application.
Your Honor, I apologize. Subsection 3 has meaning. There's a purpose to make sure the prime contractor lists themselves within a list provided under subsection 1A or 1B.
But not as to what they are doing.
That's correct, Your Honor, and there's a reason for that. Because the entire universe of the project is encompassed once the bid is opened up and they can look at, look, here's the subcontractors that are going to do more than 5% of the work on the bid amount of the project. And after 2 hours, the top three bidders, they'll have to provide all the subcontractors that will go and perform as much as, I believe it's above 1% of the work on the project.
Well, in this case, so they're saying they're going to do 51%. But we have no idea what that means, except 51%.
Your Honor, it means everything that's not listed by the subcontractors.
But no, the percentages don't work out that way. Your percentages say 25% to the listed subcontractors, 51% to the prime contractor, and we're left to guess what's going on with the other 24%. So the prime contractor has plenty of room to say, oh, this was in the 24% pile, or this is in my 51% pile. I understand their statutory point, and frankly, it seems to me that a fairer reading of the statute is paragraph 3 says the prime has to put his or her name on the list, but the list under paragraph 2 must include a description of the labor that's to be performed. That makes sense to me. My concern really is, can we reach this in this case? You can try to convince me that there's no point in having him list the work, but this case, 51, 25, and 24, if you don't list the work, then you've got a giant loophole in the statute, which we usually don't read statutes to allow.
If I may, I believe that this actually does speak to the mootness doctrine. The problem here is the specific facts in this case. The facts haven't arisen where a prime contractor has listed himself in or put his name on the list and then backed up and said, no, I never said I was going to do that work. Since there's no subcontractor, no one has to do it, and I'm allowed to now substitute in a subcontractor, and I don't have to have the implications of subsection 7, the penalties that would be applied to the prime contractor. And that's the part of the statute that hasn't been discussed yet, which I think is imperative to the reading of the entire statute. If we look at the purpose, it's to impose penalties for substituting out subcontractors to do work that's expected to be done by the prime. In this situation, The prime hasn't made any the work was completed without any effort to substitute out work that wasn't listed to be done by either a subcontractor or that was actually done by the prime. And if the prime simply puts down his name, it's presumed that he's going to be doing everything that he hasn't listed for a subcontractor because of the penalties provided in the statute. There are penalties for substituting in another subcontractor for a subcontractor that was listed. And there's penalties for substituting the work that the prime contractor was supposed to be doing. And so by putting your name down, you created a presumption you're going to be doing everything else except for a project that entails less than 1% of the bid project amount or $50,000, whichever is greater.
That's a nice argument, but when we start from the fact that we have no idea what the prime specifically is going to do, how do we know if he's substituting in or out? It's just a guess.
Your Honor, if...
He's giving us a percentage. He's not telling us what he's going to do. So obviously he has the ability not to do something because of the ambiguity.
Your Honor,
I'm not telling us specifically what he's going to do.
I think
it's almost like, you know, it's almost like a three-card Molly situation. Here's the P, but we move it. I have difficulty when you don't define what the person intends to do.
I think I understand the court's concern. The statute is built in such a way that 100% will never be listed. Moreover, it doesn't define how the work's supposed to be defined. You could get different descriptions from different primes. More importantly, a review of the statutory schemes in existence when the bid listing statutes were created in Nevada, Senate Bill 474 in 1993, they're discussed in Pacific Clark v. Crump. And an examination of those statutory schemes, even to this day with all of their amendments, still do not require the prime contractor to list the work it will perform. More importantly, Alaska has even codified the notion that if a prime contractor places its name on the list, it's presumed it's doing everything that hasn't been listed by a subcontractor, and it incurs the penalties.
Mr. Dolan, can I ask you this? I think I understand your position on this point. There's two other issues I think I'm maybe more interested in digging into, and that is the standing and the mootness. Would you tell me why, let's start with mootness, why this isn't capable of repetition? Isn't this going to happen again and again? Secondly, tell us why Mr. Russell and the union don't have standing.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I'd be happy to. The issue of mootness and capable of repetition yet evading review, the problem with that is evading review. The court asked, are there situations where larger contracts will be at issue that would allow review? And the answer is yes. And the easy way to look at that is just to look at prior cases. Pacific Clark v. Crump, once again in 1996, showed us that the project was set to be performed in 380 days. And so clearly there was plenty of time to seek judicial assistance, and which was sought in that case. And here's the key to how it was sought, an injunction was sought. In this case, the specific facts don't show that once the writ was denied, the union came back and sought a stay or an injunction before the district court or before this court pursuant to NRAP 8. Instead, they simply filed an appeal and let the process continue. They made no effort to actually halt the process. In Pacific Clark v. Crump, the parties actually sought an injunction, and it was granted, a temporary restraining order was granted, and then an injunction was granted. And then the court had time to determine the issue of whether, and it was interpretation of this exact same statute, the court had time to determine the issue of whether or not they would permit the substitution of a subcontractor, which is a different area of this same statute. Similarly, the standing issue gets back to the very issue I started with, and that's the purpose of the statute. Taxpayer standing, representational standing, or traditional notions of standing in Nevada all require some concrete harm to the litigants, some substantial interest. And clearly that's broadened in the terms of bid list statutes. Really, as long as a taxpayer in that jurisdiction is attempting in some way to protect the interests of the statute and the state and the purposes of the statute, the courts have tended to allow the case to go forward. But in this case, the purpose isn't protected. They've never once described before the district court or this court how listing the work they're going to perform, how making the prime list the work it will perform actually furthers the interests of the statute. And that's because the penalties found in subsection 7 aren't tied into any list created by the prime. Instead, they're tied into the entire cost of the project. The penalty is 2.5% of the entire project, or 35% of the estimate of the engineer, not the prime contractor, as to the amount of work that the prime should have performed that he's substituting out. And so we look to the engineer consultant's opinion. We don't look to any list created by the prime. So it's simply adding additional work, which I noted earlier, could vary from prime contractor to prime contractor. There's nothing concrete to say we're tying in this list of work to prevent bid shopping. We don't have a prime contractor who said, well, I got a new subcontractor I didn't list, and since I only said I was doing 51% of the work or more, he's doing that nebulous or undefined amount between 51% and 25%. That's not the situation we have here. Even if it were, I think it would be unreasonable to take that position, because the requirement is clear in the statute. If any work is to be performed that exceeds 3% by a subcontractor, that subcontractor has to be listed. Who else is going to perform any of the work? The prime contractor is, with the only exception being projects that require less than 1% of the cost of the bid prime. And so you have protections in place that say that if you're going to use a sub, you have to list it. If you don't list them, you're going to have to adhere to the penalties provided in subsection 7. The union asks this court to look at the entire statute. Well, the statute isn't confined to subsections 1, 2, and 3. 7 is the real point of Senate Bill 268, which amended the statute. The major changes were contained in subsection 7, because that created the penalties. And those penalties weren't tied into any list of work by the prime contractor. The penalties were tied in to the cost of the project.
Let me ask you, though, under paragraph 7, if you have a prime who ends up using a sub to do some work, and the prime hasn't, we've got this case, 51% unspecified, 25% specified, 24 presumably subs, but we don't know who or what. How would the penalty apply if the prime uses a sub and they say, oh, well, that wasn't the work we were going to perform. That was in the 24% that is suggested that this unknown sub would perform.
I think
why wouldn't that be a fair reading of the statute? I mean, Section 7 seems to me to help their side of the argument that the prime is to say specifically what work it is going to perform itself.
There's two responses, Your Honor. And I think first is there's no nebulous 24% that presumably a sub will do. The prime contractor listed in this particular case that it would do at least 51%. And the statutory interpretation presented by the RTC is that the prime simply is directed to put down its name and not to list the work it has to do.
I missed what you said.
The prime simply has to write down its name and not list the work that it's going to do.
And that is the RTC's position?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And so in that situation, if a subcontractor comes in that's not listed already in the bid and does work, the question is simply, did they do work that would exceed 3% or even 1%? Because after the bid is open, the prime has 2 hours to disclose the 1%ers. And so if any of that work exceeded 1% of the cost of the project, we can come back and say, well, the prime didn't list it there, so we know that's substituting for the work that the prime should be doing. So now the prime is going to be subject to the penalties. But once again, the penalties aren't tied into anything the prime does. They're tied into the total cost of the bid or an estimate created by the consultant engineer, not by the prime contractor himself. And so the total universe of work performed in excess of 1% is indeed covered by the statute already. It carries the same presumption that's created in Alaska, that's codified in Alaska, pardon me, and that exists in California and that exists in New Mexico. There's been no demonstration of how bid shopping would be prevented specifically in this situation, because that really is the harm that the legislature was trying to protect against, because they saw bid shopping as an evil. Well, if you have a subcontractor come in and do work that's not listed, and that work exceeds 1%, then the penalties of subsection 7 apply. There's no need to look to the list of the prime contractor. And that logically follows because, as I stated before, what the prime contractor lists isn't defined as to how much detail or how little detail needs to go in there. And the main reason for that is it doesn't matter in terms of any of the penalties created by Senate Bill 268. The penalties are found in subsection 7, and that's the way the statute protects the purposes of the bill. There's no nexus between what is happening within the, pardon me, I see I'm out of time here.
You may wrap up.
There's no nexus between the duty sought by the union and the actual purposes that are trying to be achieved by the statute, because they're achieved already within the statutory code. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Langton, you have 1 minute.
Thank you. I'll be quick. Obviously, the legislature is presumed to know exactly what it intended when it used the words must at least four times in that statute and shall at least twice in that time. Those are mandatory words. The purpose is to protect the public. I think that's pretty obvious. This court has held that it is to do it. There is no exception that a presumption can be made if you say you're going to do in excess of 51%. I think your question about Section 7, Your Honor, was right on, is that that occurs after the award and actually occurs sometimes after the project has been ongoing. So when and if that occurs, that becomes an issue. But you don't know if the prime contractor hasn't specifically listed and identified the work that is to be done, whether or not that section's been violated. That's exactly why the legislature, in my opinion, said you must, as a prime contractor, identify the work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. This matter will stand submitted, and we will...